Not many magicians are household names, but my guest today is one of the very few British ones to fall into that category. Paul Daniels was a star of Saturday night television for 15 years, getting audiences of 15 million, phenomenal by today's standards. And Paul, you've chosen as your great life perhaps the world's most famous magician ever, or should we call him a magician?
He started out that way. Certainly a bit later on he went to become an escapologist. We are, of course, talking about Harry Houdini.
A lot of people will balk at the very idea of calling him a magician. He's just associated with locks and keys and being underwater and all that kind of thing.
Well, yes, I suppose they would balk, but magic is the defiance of all our laws that bind us physically. You know, science, do you remember the teacher? Your matter cannot be created. Poof, there's a girl. You know, good-looking matter. And matter cannot be destroyed. Bing, she's gone. That kind of thing. Solid matter can't penetrate solid matter. I push Penelope Keith through a plate of glass, you see. That's what magic is. Now, it has allied arts, of which escapology is one of them, where you are bound up and you escape. The way Houdini made that magical was, if he was escaping from a straitjacket, you saw him do it. He'd be hanging upside down from a skyscraper crane or whatever. You saw him do it. But some of it, he would be put into cabinets, boxes, whatever, even the great water torture escape. That would have a curtain round it. So was it magical? Houdini used a little bit of this, a little bit of that. He used, of course, technical knowledge, but he started out doing magic, and he started out doing card manipulations, you know, on stage. And he worked the Carney route and all that, which is like fairgrounds that we have over here. Whereas I bummed around all of the working men's clubs, he bummed around any dive he could get a job in.
Hundreds of books have been written and still being written about Houdini. But among the most authoritative and most recent is one co-authored by New Yorker William Kalush, who is himself a magician and a historian of magic. He joins us, as if by magic, on the line from Vienna. William, same question for you. Is escapology a kind of magic, or is it, in fact, just a skill?
It's absolutely not only a form of magic, but a very high form of magic. Because if you think about it, he's doing a performance. It's a miracle-like performance, yet he's got a secret. It really falls into the formula of what magic performance is. But what's special about escapology or being an escape artist is that Houdini can also sell it as though it's the real thing. And even though Houdini might not say that he's being helped by supernatural, which of course he never would have said, it still has the feeling in the ring as though he could actually escape out of any situation under any circumstances, which makes it real. And in fact, that's not exactly the case.
So far as we know, Harry Houdini only recorded his voice once on an Edison wax disc in 1914. The quality isn't all that brilliant, but we ought to hear it. He was aged 40 at the time.
Ladies and gentlemen, in introducing my original invention, the water torture cell, although there is nothing supernatural about it, I am willing to profit the sum of $1,000 to anyone who can prove that it is possible to obtain air inside of the torture cell when I'm locked up in it in the regulation manner after it has been filled with water.
The accent isn't quite what I expected there, Paul.
No, the first time I heard it, I thought, wow, this guy's speaking with an English accent. I know to modern Americans, they say, well, you know, it's mid-European, but I don't hear that.
He was born in Budapest, wasn't he, Paul?
Yeah, he celebrated, it wasn't his real birthday, but he celebrated the 6th of April.
as
his birthday. I don't know, but I do know that's my birthday.
Would it have been too much for him, William, just to have celebrated his real birthday rather than made one up?
There's a good question as to whether, at least early in his life, I think we solved the question as to whether he ever knew his actual birthday. I think he did.
Yeah.
But I think early in his life, he may not actually have known his birthday, and that his mother celebrated April 6th for some mysterious reason, and he just stuck to that.
Yeah, he looked into the future, and he saw this great magician coming along, me, and he took my birthday. That's what he did.
Exactly.
And by the way, he died on my wife's birthday, which is the only reason I married her. So I could tell that story.
No. And he changed his name, too. His original name was Erich Weiss, is that right?
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah.
Tell me, William, a little bit about his family background, his father, his mother. What kind of people produce a Houdini?
His father was a soap maker originally, who seemingly put himself through law school, became a lawyer in Budapest, and then for a mysterious reason yet to be determined, left for America, where there wasn't any demand in Appleton, Wisconsin, where he ended up, for Hungarian lawyers. So when one of the town elders said, well, what can you do? He said, I don't know, what do you need? He said, well, we have a lot of Jewish families here, but no rabbi. He said, a rabbi? That sounds like me. And he became the town's rabbi.
Yeah.
And the relationship with Houdini's father is very important because he made Houdini swear an oath to take care of the family on two occasions, and he kind of jumped past Houdini's two older brothers. He had two older and two younger brothers, and a younger sister later. And it was interesting because on his father's deathbed, he asked Houdini to swear that he would take care of the family, specifically his mother, which Houdini took very seriously for the rest of his life, and he absolutely did take care of her.
How did he get into the magic business?
The big point was when he read a book, an autobiography by a fellow named Jean-Eugène Robert Houdin. And Robert Houdin was the great father of modern magic, who was a Frenchman who performed in Paris from about 1845 to 1853. And Houdini really was moved by this book to the point where he split Robert Houdin's name to Houdin, and he added an I and became Houdini.
Robert Houdin was the first guy really to get rid of all the old cloaks and the pointy hats, and he dressed in the manner of the time. And he was a great magical inventor. He was the first guy. It's quite common now to see the broomstick illusion and stuff like that, but he came up with that because ether had just been invented. And magicians have always tended to say, oh, this is new, let's put it in the act. And his son pretended to be wafted away by ether and could float in the air. He was the man, and I can fully understand Erich Weiss wanting, because I believe he believed that adding an I meant like Houdin.
But Houdini, as his career started to progress, he was an autodidact. He was a self-taught man, a very bright guy, but not educated properly. And he felt that he had to become an expert in all facets of his field to be respected. And that's what he was really searching for, was great respect. And at one point, he felt he had to prove that he was Robert Houdin's master by kind of destroying his legacy. And it's really one of the uglier points in Houdini's life, in my opinion. I think it's quite an embarrassing thing that he did, and I think it was disgraceful.
But also at that time, you've got to remember, show business was really hard, really tough. I mean, guys like Al Jolson, if you were funny on his show or getting great applause, you were out.
Yeah, but come on here, Paul. I mean, you're recommending Houdini as a great life, and here's a man who devotes part of his life to destroying the reputation of a man who's already dead. It's not a very nice thing to do.
No, it isn't, and everybody's got hiccups in their life.
Paul, I wonder whether things have come full circle. Although Houdini is your great life, in some ways he took magic and illusion off in a different direction, whereas his great role model, Robert Houdin, was more of a traditional magician, as you have become, back onto the stage with a box of tricks and all the rest. So perhaps you've more followed Houdin than Houdini.
Yes, I have. But the reason I think Houdini is a great life is because this is a man who comes from nowhere, a family that comes from nowhere, and he builds up his art form, suddenly realizes that to escape from stuff has more appeal than doing card flinging, finger flinging, and builds that into a career that has never been equaled.
But, William, just looking at the man himself, I mean, we're looking at massive insecurity, aren't we?
Well, everybody's got a complex personality, and it's common to talk about Houdini as an egomaniac and insecure, and of course all of us have some of those things. But if you really get under the skin, he's the sort of fellow who could never say no. When he had just started to make some money, he was just coming out of living on park benches himself, and he was paying a retirement that a co-worker at a tie factory when he was a boy was getting cheated out of, and he was paying it out of his own pocket. He was that kind of a guy.
How did he take off? How did the career take off? And when did this big change in his approach to magic occur?
Well, what he did is he had this great illusion. Another reason why Houdini's not just an escape artist is because he started out as a great magician, but he retained that all through his life. And Houdini did this great thing called the metamorphosis. He had himself all bound up in a bag and chained, and then the bag was put in a big trunk, and the trunk was tied up. And then they had a curtain around it, and the wife would stand in front of the box and close the curtain, and the curtain would be opened, and he'd be there. It was about a three-second time frame. And it really felt like a miracle. And he turned that into a challenge. So I'm going to do it now, but you can tie me up any way you'd like. And then he quickly turned that into, you can bring your own handcuffs and you can chain me up. And he found out within a couple of weeks that people at home didn't have handcuffs. So he shifted that to police departments. And this thing starts snowballing. And before he knew what was happening, he became the king of handcuffs. And then he parlayed that into the king of all escapes.
You're listening to BBC Radio 4. I'm Matthew Paris, and my guest on Great Lives this week is the magician Paul Daniels. He's chosen Harry Houdini, whose biographer, William Kalouche, is our expert witness. Paul, do you think escapology is now, after Houdini's death, a dead art?
No, escapology's gone on for a long time. It's still going on. Tends to have focused on the straitjacket. In my years of television, though, I did triple trunk escapes. I've done a metal welded coffin escape and stuff like that. And from time to time, along will come a David Blaine and he'll be buried alive or iced up or whatever. Interesting, though, that David didn't get out of the ice block. I thought he would escape. If he was hot stuff like me, it would have melted anyway. But it was just, for me, escapology. Everything goes round and round and round, you know, it comes back.
As you may be aware, I'm the producer of David Blaine's TV shows with him, and I've also created his stunts with him. And I think that we're really, truly taking one right out of Houdini's playbook when we do a live stunt. We get real people to show up. There's a purpose. He accomplishes something great. And it's very interesting. Now, you could say that, well, these stunts aren't magic, they're endurance. But if you define magic the way I do, which is anything that science says is impossible is magic, well, a lot of the stunts that David's done, now this isn't every single stunt, but the water stunt, for example, and the fasting stunt that he did in the UK, both, we were told, were absolutely impossible by scientists. There was no chance, according to the top neurologist that we talked to, that he could hold his breath past 15 minutes. That was the limit to human life. And I've seen him do it at 20 minutes. I probably shouldn't say that. But his record is 17 minutes and 4 seconds.
But, Paul, this isn't magic. This is just athletics.
No, I think that the water stunt, for example, I think was magical. But sitting in the glass box wasn't. And starving yourself, I don't think that was magical in its presentation. I think the producer got it all wrong. How are you feeling now, William? But it was just. I think those were perceived, certainly over here, as endurance.
But Paul, in my book anyway, not cheating is actually cheating, because a magician is supposed to cheat. There's supposed to be an illusion, and if you simply discover that the fellow has learnt how not to breathe underwater, that's very interesting from the biological point of view, but it entirely escapes the world of illusion and of magic.
No, I mean, at the end of the day, whether you believe it's magic or whether you believe it's endurance or whether you believe... it's part and parcel of show business. Mm. This is getting people's attention.
And amazing them.
And baffling them and amazing them and making them go, wow. And I still loop back now to the king of all of that, Houdini. And he was the absolute master of making people go, wow.
How much of it is charisma and how much of it is sheer skill?
I don't think you can really separate them. I mean, you can get away with charisma for quite a while, but it's the old thing, you know, you can't fool all of the people all the time. I believe he had tremendous knowledge about the escape business and its locks and the methods of tying and all that. Added to that, he'd already gone through the school of learning sleight of hand, and that was hidden away sometimes in the escapes.
He wasn't above a little setup here and a little setup there. And he had police. Now, I wouldn't say that he bribed policemen to help him. And one of the parts in my book, I don't really reveal secrets in that book, but I felt I had to talk about how he got out of jail cells, because I, as a kid, when I read these stories, I thought, well, he probably just bribed the policeman. But in fact, he had all kinds of extremely clever methods. In fact, Paul alluded to one. He used sleight of hand. He'd sometimes hide the key right on the back of the jailer and then retrieve it after he'd been searched.
And he had shoes, didn't he, that had been hollowed out?
He had all kinds of things.
All kinds of stuff. I tell you what I've got in my funny old collection. He used to offer a cash prize. A lot of guys did around that time. If you could solve the mystery and this and that. And one of them was if you could turn up with a pair of handcuffs I couldn't get out of. And there was a gentleman who worked on the Indian Railway as an engineer. And this guy turns up with a set of handcuffs, which I've got, that will lock on but don't unlock. And Houdini, from that moment, changed the challenge. The guy got the cash, but Houdini changed the challenge then to any handcuffs that I haven't examined beforehand.
You're both disillusioning me a little bit here, because I, in my simple way, have always thought of Houdini as a great escapologist in the sense that he really knew how to unpick locks. He really knew how to do these things.
Yes, he did.
But you're suggesting that sometimes the things have been fiddled or fixed in advance?
No, that's not enough. To know how to get out is not enough. I mean, you need to know more than that, because you are going to meet stuff that you've never seen before, a lock design you've never seen before.
He's primarily an entertainer, so you can't just expect the audience to come to the theater. Remember, he built his name. The reason we're talking about Houdini today is because he created the concept of the challenge. He's not the magician who brings his props on stage and does some tricks. He's a guy who, in appearances, says, you, the packing people at Gimbel's, come to the theater with your lumber and your nails, and you build the box, and I'll escape from it, and I won't even damage it. And that's what he did. Now, he set the rules, how big's the box, what kind of nails did they use instead of screws, these kinds of things. But that's what I mean by setting it up. He didn't cheat it necessarily, but what he did most of the time was make sure he knew what the challenge was. I mean, it's just being a wise performer.
Yeah, it had to be of a size that he could move, you know. I mean, I got locked into a box and I couldn't move at all in any direction. I don't know that thing was made for, but I'm a small guy. He was smaller than me, smaller than Houdini, must have been.
Did you get out?
Yes. I had to have it opened so I could have a look around inside the box, and then I got back in, and I was in a slightly different position and able to manipulate things.
Did the audience become aware of your plight?
Oh, yes. They were really sweating for me, because at that time, it's horrendous, because I was claustrophobic. And getting back in that, I think, was the worst thing I ever did in my life. But that's the way it goes.
Was he good on stage, William?
I think he had to have been absolutely tremendous on stage. I mean, some of the reviews that he got, and I'm not talking about magician reviews, I'm talking about papers like Billboard, Variety. Talk about, he did a thing where he walked through a wall very briefly in his career. And this is nothing but an illusion. It's got nothing to do with escapes, really. And he brought the audience to complete silence. Now, this wasn't because they didn't like it. Later, they brought him back for four curtain calls, but he dumbfounded his audience. And he had a charisma and a power that's very rare. He once performed for 18 weeks straight on the stage of the New York Hippodrome, a theater in New York City, it's no longer there, that had 5,000 seats. And he did a little thing with some needles and some thread, and he kept the audience in the palm of his hand.
This huge stage charm, and I'm convinced by what you and William say that the charm was real as well as stage charm. And then the other side to his his life, the insecurity, the jealousy, the resentment of competitors and rivals. Do you understand that from your own career? Have you felt that worrying that people are better than you? And
no, I think what you do worry about is where's the next show coming from? I mean, this is how you go out and hunt for your food. And I think that in your dark hours in the night, I think it becomes something to consider carefully. But you see, another factor of Houdini was that for 20 years after his death, his wife, Bess, she worked with a publicist. And they continued to build the legend of Houdini.
But he became a mythological character who could defeat authority. I think this is where his real fame came from.
So Houdini became stupendously successful, but there was, William, wasn't there a tremendous physical toll involved?
Enormous, enormous. In fact, you have to realize that if David Blaine does a stunt, he prepares for a long time, and he does it one time usually. Houdini would do these really difficult stunts over and over and over again. And one of the reasons he pushed into film was because he was trying to lighten the burden, the physical burden of what he was doing with escapes. Remember, he built his entire career when there was nothing but newspapers to generate news. There was no radio. There was no television. Film was brand new, and he jumped on it the minute he had the opportunity. Even before his film career, which was not completely a dismal failure. It was a success at the beginning, and it did spread his fame around the world. There are, in the collections around the world, there are love notes from Japanese girls, etc.
You asked earlier, why did he go to the prisons and police and the jails and all that? And William has just come up with why he did it. He did it because everything was local. And so you had to regenerate the interest in every town he went to. So in every town he went to the prison. And the local press couldn't resist that, and off they'd go. And that was all part and parcel of the publicity.
Why did the police let him do this?
Well, if you go to the States, the sheriff does like publicity.
He did it around the UK as well, and there were some that wouldn't do it. I mean, there were absolutely some that were against it, but I think they just thought it was good fun and they didn't have any trouble. And
that's right.
You know, hey, maybe they would be the guy who would lock the cuffs on the kid and he wouldn't get out, and they would get some notoriety themselves.
Yeah.
Let me ask you both about a huge element in his life and career that we haven't talked about yet, and that was his huge combat with spiritualists, mediums, and spiritualism. Why did this become so big a dragon for him to slay, do you think, Paul?
Well, he did lose his mom, and he did try to get in touch with his mom. And everywhere he went to mediums, and you can do this, any good, competent magician can do this, you can see what they're up to, certainly in those days, because it was a lot more physical in those days. I think it was in the late 50s in this country that the creation of physical phenomena during a seance was declared illegal. And from that moment on, they all just started to hear voices. But Houdini was really against it because he felt they were trying to con the greatest con of them all, him.
So in a way, William, he was kind of a disappointed would-be spiritualist.
Well, he actually was a spiritualist, a fraudulent spiritualist, early in his career, at the point where he almost gave up, quit magic entirely, and went on to become a locksmith. He toured around doing fraudulent seances. It was Sir Arthur Conan Doyle that tried to lure him back in with a seance to to find his mother. And you have to realize that Houdini was a seeker. He didn't hate the concept of communication with the dead. He hated the fraud. He spent his life making pacts, including one with his own brother, to try to get his brother to communicate with him once he'd passed on. And I truly believe he spent his life seeking. And then once Conan Doyle tried to trap him, I think that's what turned him into really a vehement antagonist to fraudulent spiritualists.
But isn't there an element of magicians resenting the competition they're getting from spiritualists?
No, that's a good argument. They always come up with that. But I would love to meet somebody who could really do it, whether it's spiritualism or magic of any kind.
But, you guys are all in the same business, so spiritualists, priests, magicians. You're all in the business of...
Oh, indeed, indeed. Magic started it all. But we say out loud, we cheat.
Right. You know? That's exactly, Paul's exactly right. Any one of us would love to see a miracle that we just couldn't understand. But convince us that it's real. We're the best audience in the world.
How, William, did Houdini pursue his campaign against spiritualists and spiritualism?
Well, he stopped performing as much when it came to escapes, and he spent an enormous amount of his money because he created an entire, what he called his own secret service, that went out and would seek out these fraudulent spiritualists, find out what they were doing, figure it out, and then Houdini would go do a lecture in the town and expose who these people were and what they were doing.
Tell me about the circumstances of his death.
They say an unguarded blow from a student.
There were several people that punched him at the same over the course of a weekend in Montreal.
How did the punches happen?
He said he could withstand blows to the stomach. He was incredibly fit. He was incredibly tough. It was a weird world. There was one guy who used to stand in front of a cannon and have the cannonball fired at his stomach, you know. So Houdini...
Are you having me on here?
No, I saw it at Middlesbrough Empire. Hmm. Yeah. So going back in time, Houdini'd get punched in the stomach, could take a good punch in the stomach, as most modern boxers could. But in this particular case, you have to tense up. You have to be muscular tensed to withstand the blow.
He died of peritonitis, and it looks very likely, it's very likely he had appendicitis that was aggravated or hidden by these unguarded punches.
There were theories, William, that he had been poisoned, hence the peritonitis.
I'm suspicious, I'll put it that way, that there's more to the story than we know. We found some heretofore undiscovered material from Sir Arthur Conan Doyle and some of his cohorts that really had it in for Houdini that sound... Now, maybe I'm just leading myself, but they sound like a little bit like we got the guy. And we do know that Houdini had discovered that his arch nemesis, a fellow named Dr. Crandon, had been adopting little boys from England, and they were disappearing. And Crandon knew this, and all of a sudden Houdini ended up dead. So I'm not saying there's causation, but it was convenient.
Now, gentlemen, I'm a disappointed man. I came along to this discussion with a merry heart, thinking, what fun, magicians, magic, cheerfulness, laughter, peals of amusement, and I'm plunged into a world of suspicion and paranoia and rivalry and conspiracy and suggestions that people might have killed other people. Is the world of magic really like this, Paul?
Aren't comedians pretty sad when they're off? It's the same.
My thanks to my guests this week on Great Lives, where Paul Daniels has been championing the life of Harry Houdini, and William Kalouche has been our expert witness. Goodbye.